to Dean Hill, this incredible choir. Sunday after Sunday, my wife is here when I'm not here to hear this choir and also Dean Hill preach. To the awaiting congregation, for those who are in radio land and on internet, we greet you on this very cold, very, very cold Boston day, when we remember the life and legacy of our most famous alumnus of this university, and perhaps one of the greatest Americans, of course, who ever lived, Martin Luther King Jr. I'm a Baptist preacher, and it takes about 20 minutes to clear my throat and my thoughts. So I'd like for you to know that the text that I'm using today really comes from an old African-American spiritual. It's a refrain that plays out over and over again. It says, if I could, I surely would stand on the rock where Moses stood. We all need places to stand. In our public and private lives, in the midst of the circling processes of social and political warfare that now haunt this nation, we need places to stand. Among the poor, and now our increasingly new poor in America, we need a place to stand. And perhaps the place to stand is indeed firm and sustaining like a rock, but it's probably more like what Dean Thurman used to say here. It's a fluid center from which we can stand that is firm, but it's not fixed forever and ever. Or what Thomas Merton said once, a place to stand in the center of the world, which is also the center of our being. These old African-American singers had a sense of this. They said, if I could, I surely would stand on the rock where Moses stood. They were what one scholar calls bricoleurs. They would take the immediate materials of their experience, and they would refashion them into tools of the Spirit, which allowed them to not only exegete history and time, but to find a way to make meaning out of chaos. Without the gifts and the skills of higher biblical criticism and all of the commentaries we preachers use, these early singers took their own experience of suffering and oppression and refashioned it into a way of seeing the world that helped them to better understand their own inherent dignity and worth. It's really a marvelous thing. It was as if they were quilting, taking fragments of things that were desecrated and thrown away and creating new art. When they would hear the stories of the Bible, they would begin quilting, rearranging, never maybe receiving the whole story, but enough of the stories to refashion meaning for themselves. When Israel was in Egypt's land, let my people go. Oppressed so hard they could not stand, let my people go. Go down, Moses, way down in Egypt's land. Tell old Pharaoh to let my people go. The theme in all of these spirituals, which holds them together, is the way in which these early singers would hold in tension, suffering, and hope. W.E.B. Du Bois had written that on one hand, these are sorrow songs, songs of very unhappy people who are disinherited. And these songs, he said, lead to hidden paths and misty ways. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child, such a long ways from home. On the other hand, they would speak to the strivings of a people who, though set aside and as foul and profane, and who had no way of shaping the communities of discourse that would respect their rights as citizens, would still hope in a future where they would be a part of a new kind of world where they had active participation. So they would sing songs like, "Oh, what a beautiful city. Oh, what a beautiful city. Oh, what a beautiful city. 12 gates to the city. Hallelujah. 3 gates in the east, 3 gates in the west, 3 gates in the north, 3 gates in the south. Though this world of this loss of world, this anomie that casts me out, it still can be remade, refashioned into a world where I'm an active participant in an inclusive world where there are 12 gates to the city. Everybody has access." And finally, they would sing songs about trouble, because their lot was trouble. Soon be done with the troubles of the world. Troubles of the world. Troubles of the world. Soon will be done with the troubles of the world. Going to live with God. James Weldon called them these black and unknown bards who would sing songs both of sorrow and hope. And even when hope would feed on itself, they would still imagine a world. And what helped them to imagine this world was standing on a rock. That's why when they would sing, they'd say, "God is a rock in a weary land, a weary land, a weary land. God is a rock in a weary land." Out of a kind of apocalyptic consciousness, they would see a new world breaking in on the present. And that's why they would also sing, "Elijah rock, shout, shout. Elijah rock, coming of the Lord. If I could, I surely would stand on the rock where Moses stood." And sometimes it's elegiac. They'd remember the story of Mary, Martha, and their brother Lazarus. And they say, "Oh, Mary, don't you weep. Tell Martha, don't you moan. Because Pharaoh's army got drowned in the Red Sea." The improvisational artistry of these black and unknown bards. "If I could, I surely would. What a word this is for us as we reflect on Martin Luther King Jr., as our nation is caught in the throes of suffering and hope. As we look to King's legacy in this new time, this new millennium, where all kinds of epithets are being hurled at the poor, and indeed where many of us in our private lives are seeking a place to stand, Martin Luther King's message to us is all the more relevant. But in order to understand Martin Luther King Jr., his valiant and courageous descent into the very deep segregated regions of this country and to the teeming ghettos of the North, in order to understand that, you must understand that Martin King was part of this tradition, which sang over and over again, "If I could, I surely would." Long before he was catapulted into national and international prominence, after the Montgomery bus boycott, long before he stood at the Lincoln Memorial and declared to a pilgrimage of thousands that America had written its citizens of color a bad check that had come back marked insufficient funds, long before his campaigns for open public accommodation and voting rights, long before his outspoken stance on an unjust war in Vietnam, these black and unknown bards had left him and us a legacy and a place to stand. I often, as a King scholar, hear about who King studied with, read about who King studied with, and what King studied, and what he graciously appropriated. But the vision of King, I would add, was enriched by his studies at Crozer Theological Seminary and certainly here at Boston University. But long before King came to Boston, long before his discovery of nonviolent resistance in Henry David Thoreau and Mahatma Gandhi, long before he read Rousseau and Hobbes and Nietzsche and Kierkegaard and Royce and Rauschenbusch and Niebuhr and Baum and Brightman and DeWolf and Mulder, Hegel, Marx, Wyman, and Tillich, long before, he was part of a dream of a dispossessed and disinherited people who simply wanted to be free, and who wanted to be able to stand on a rock where Moses stood. I close this morning with a thought. My wife and I were among the representatives of the university who attended the dedication of the memorial in October of last year. And for me, it was such a moving moment. There on the Washington Mall, this huge monument between Lincoln's memorial and Thomas Jefferson's memorial, depicted as a mountain, and out of the mountain is hewed a stone of hope. King stands there unflinching, resolute, unsmiling, certain. He gazes across the tidal basin towards the Jefferson Monument, and on the other side is Lincoln, the great emancipator. And it's as if King, who certainly knew Lincoln and Jefferson, is aware of the inherent contradiction. In Jefferson and in Lincoln, struggling with a nation that promised something different for the people of the world. As I stood there, I was deeply moved to a place that said, "He's standing on the rock." And oh God, if I could, I surely would. I'd stand on a rock where Martin stood. My friends, as you leave this day and begin your commemorations of Martin Luther King Jr., know that we are heirs of his legacy. We have a place to stand in this nation, in this world, and to speak to issues that most concern the future of democracy and equality in this nation. And if you do dare to stand on this rock with King and all of those who came before him, know that whatever you do, that politics ultimately cannot legislate it. Fire can't burn it, King would tell you. Water hoses can't drown it. Even death cannot destroy it, because it lives in the mind of the Creator and the Maker of the world. And when God mandates justice, all we can do is stand on the rock.